You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue. Going to see if we can get Grant Newsham. It's always a bit of a challenge. Uh-oh, Houston, we have communication. Newsham, he lives.
Worked out pretty well. Yeah.
Yeah, Grant. First of all, good morning or good evening. Where are you? Where's Waldo today?
I'm in Tokyo right now.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, how are things in Tokyo?
Oh, okay. I think they're seems to be happy that Mr. Trump is here, and particularly that Ivanka came 2 days early. I think a tall blonde woman gets a lot of attention in the media, so she was as popular as him, probably.
Well, that's good to know. It's always good to know that American exports play well overseas. And, yeah, we saw that she had created a bit of a stir. So, good for Ivanka, right? Any goodwill, certainly, in these trying times. Wanted to have, for those of you who don't know, Grant is a retired, Marine officer, spent much of his life in the Pacific and, you can find his writings in Asia Times online, and so he comes on occasion and makes us smart about things in the Pacific Rim. He also reminds us that he picks the Washington Redskins to win the Super Bowl on a regular basis. So so again, like all good professionals, he admonishes us about his ability to look into his own crystal ball. With all of that said, Grant, this is a big trip for the president. Give me your thoughts on what's the most important thing the president's going to do during these 2 weeks.
Well, he's going to come out here. He's going to, visit Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and Manila. I think he's just going to come out and represent America and try to get across that America is still in Asia, is still interested, and is not going anywhere. But really what matters most is what he does when he comes back and whether or not that we have matching policies and matching sort of initiatives to really add something concrete to the U.S. position in Asia, particularly as it involves challenging steady and persistent Chinese aggression, really, to dominate the region and to push the U.S. out. Probably the one only thing that I'm really a little concerned about is when he gets to China, if he's not careful, and if he's, say, lets the flattery get to his head, he could make it look as though he's acquiescing too much in what China wants, instead of making it clear that we're not backing down, period. There really is no splitting the difference with China. And if you give that impression that you can be rolled or that you're not serious, then that is a strategic sort of loss or disadvantage that he could put us at. But that's, I think, that's what the biggest danger is. Somehow, he lets the Chinese think that they can push and America will not push back.
Okay, so from the Japanese perspective, this is first and foremost about North Korea. But also, we've seen that not too far behind that agenda item are events in the East China Sea, and certainly they've been tracking events in the South China Sea. So is it better for the United States to position itself, in your opinion, in an adversarial position with the Chinese? Is that better for the United States and for American foreign policy?
They're going to have to do that. Yes, we've been trying to do the opposite for the last 45 years, and we are within a hair's breadth of being elbowed out of this region. The Chinese effectively have de facto control of the South China Sea, and that's getting stronger, literally by the week. And that the East China Sea is next.
Hold on. Explain that. What, you know, in terms of stronger, what do you mean? More islands? You know, more forces on those islands? What do you mean?
They are improving the military capabilities on those islands. When the time is right, they're going to build at least one more, probably Scarborough Shoal, the one that they took from the Chinese in 2012, but haven't filled it in yet. But they are improving, expanding the military capabilities on these islands. But additionally, China is building ships at a rapid clip, military ships, and these are very capable ships. They've got more of them out here than we do by quite a lot. And I say these are capable ships. In some ways, they surpass us, particularly in the range of anti-ship cruise missiles. Their anti-submarine technology, the sensor systems, the networks they're putting into the South China Sea are getting better, which counters one of our main advantages is our submarines. And they're building more and better aircraft. Their stealth technology is good. You know, just for so long, the Americans thought, well, we'll always be ahead of the Chinese, but that is not the case anymore. So they are improving their military capabilities. They're putting more stuff, more places, and they're getting better at using it. They understand the importance of joint capability and have really transformed the People's Liberation Army in recent years. And they've still got plenty of problems, but I would not dismiss them at all. They are really caught up. And the South China Sea is just a foretaste of what's coming elsewhere.
And then Reed, next will be East China Sea.
Well, yeah, the Chinese, this was a couple of years ago that I heard it said from the Chinese side that they thought anytime they wanted, they could take administrative control of the Senkaku Islands, those small islands in the southern, in the Ryukyus, south of Japan, that Japan owns, but that China wants, so they claim they're Chinese. And they know that anytime they want, they can take them. And they say when the time is right. And there really is no limit. China will take whatever it can get away with. So for Mr. Trump to come out here, he has to leave the Chinese with a very clear sense that something has changed and that they will be met militarily, but also economically. And this is an area of concern, is he may think that, well, since he's a businessman and somehow economic relations are different and unrelated to military relations and strategic jostling and jockeying for position. And that's a potential vulnerability on our side, because you really got to, once again, not just push back militarily, but particularly economically, because China has been allowed to play by their own rules. They've been accommodated. And the build up the strength of the Chinese economy over the last 30 years is almost entirely the result of the United States supporting China and allowing it to do what it does. Letting them into the World Trade Organization really set the sort of open the floodgates. But additionally, America has its own problems. A blame for this is, which is, we can't get our own economic house in order. So as long as you're borrowing a whole lot of money more than you're making, you're going to become dependent on the people lending you the money. And China and Japan have been the ones who've principally lent us that money. Japan is an ally, and there are limits to what they will do. China is not an ally, and there is no limit to what they will do.
All right, on that cheery assessment, we circled the South China Sea as a place that we're concerned about. We probably ought to be more concerned about. pushed out of the region. That's not a good thing for the United States. But it seemed, I just read the investigations into the Fitzgerald and the McCain, and they're awful. They're absolutely awful in terms of basic seamanship, going to sea and driving your ship. And if that's any indication of other capabilities in the United States Navy, the United States Navy is sick right now. And so, it's concerning to say the least, our status out in the Pacific. How does the president walk this line then? Let's stick to Japan before we bring China into it. There's some thoughts that Kim Jong-un will fire, a missile, while, you know, the president of the United States is in the vicinity. Your thoughts on that? Will he do that?
Oh, he might. Yeah, and that's about as much as anybody knows, is that he might. You know, if he doesn't do it while Mr. Trump is in Asia, he'll do it afterwards. But nobody really knows that. But it is possible. That could be. And North Korea is something that really worries the Japanese, not surprisingly, because it's so close. You know, this would be as if Mexico was shooting missiles off and threatening to shoot them into the United States while shooting them over the United States. So you can see how the Japanese are really worried about that. And their objective, Japan's objective with Mr. Trump coming, is to sort of reconfirm the relationship and that it's solid. And they do this with every president, going back really all the way to the first George Bush at least. And it's almost like a married couple where one of them keeps asking, do you love me? You know, just over and over and over, and needs to be told, yes, I really do. Which means if they keep asking you, they really don't. They really wonder. And that has always been part of the U.S.-Japan relationship, was the Japanese not really believing America will defend them. That doesn't mean Japan will do everything they need to do to make sure we will defend them. But they certainly are concerned that we won't protect them. And that's what's part of what's going on here, is an effort to reassure themselves that the Americans are going to stick with them. And they're hoping Mr. Trump comes and goes without raising the trade issue too much, which I hope he doesn't raise too much, because that's not the big thing out here in Asia. It's not, you know, a trade deficit with Japan, which is tiny compared to what we have with China. So there's two things. There's that, particularly they want to make sure that they do have American commitment to defend Japan from North Korea, but also from China, and also to have Mr. Trump leave happy, and to avoid some sort of a dispute over trade while he's here. So we'll see how it goes, but I think it'll go fine in the Japan end. And he's only in most of these places for a couple days, so it's not a long time, but he'll do well. And he, I noticed today on the Japanese TV news that he met with the families of the Japanese who were kidnapped, whose children were kidnapped by the North Koreans in the 70s mostly, and a few before, a few after. And this was probably one of the most decent things a president has done in Asia in a good long while, because previous administrations have refused to meet with these people, thinking it will offend North Korea or whatever stupid reason they have. And Trump had the decency to do this, and you know, he's got some good advice from somewhere. But this is a big deal for the Japanese to have him do that, but also just in a sort of a sense of just basic decency, that it was a good thing to see the President of the United States meet with these people. And it looked just on the TV that I saw, he does well. He looks sincere. And he looks concerned by it. So that was something that was, I think most people won't pick up on, but I think that was a good thing. And it's worth keeping in mind that the Japanese Socialist Party, and of course the Japanese Communist Party, for many, many years insisted that no Japanese had been kidnapped by North Korea. And then finally, one day, North Korea admitted it in the early 2000s.
Oops.
But for years, they were just the shills for North Korea. And they still pretty much are, but they're not a major factor in Japanese politics.
Grant Newsham, my guest here on a Monday morning. Grant, the Associated Press filed a story about an hour ago. Trump says U.S. will arm Japan to knock down Korean missiles. Talk to us about this. And here's a quote. We will shoot him out of the sky when he completes the purchase of lots of additional military equipment from the United States, Trump said of Abe. He will easily shoot them out of the sky. So Japan is has a constitution that limits what it does. They seem to be happy with that. You've kind of made it smart about certain elements of that. Talk to us about this. Was this prescribed? Is this unexpected? It has been much discussed, or at least much mentioned, the fact that this could happen. Your thoughts, and make it smart.
Oh, I think what Mr. Trump is referring to is that the Japanese are going to be buying some more advanced, ballistic missile defenses. I believe they've actually been co-developing these with the United States, so it's not as big a deal as it sounds. I think so. He was briefed of what's going on, and I think this is how it translates to a guy from Queens. They're going to buy some better stuff, better hardware that will improve their capabilities to shoot down North Korean missiles. But this is something that, even if he hadn't said it, this was still in the works, and it's just a natural, it's been coming along naturally. I forget what the particular type of system is, but this has been in the works for a while, and the Japanese are even talking about putting the Aegis system ashore, although their timeline for installing it is about 6 years or something like that, an awfully long time. But they have something, some better missiles coming along shortly. So they're getting incrementally better in their missile defenses.
Got it. The here's an email for you. Hey, Mac, is there any space between Japan and South Korea in all of this? Are we all playing on the same team right now? Historically, I know that South Korea and Japan have differences. Have those been put aside? Are we all good? Grant?
No, not really. The Japanese bring out the worst in the Koreans. Koreans just for whatever reason cannot help themselves. This resentment of the Japanese really does shape Korean thinking and Korean behavior in an unhelpful way, and I would suggest an unnatural way. You'd have to go to places like the Balkans to find this kind of dislike, or Northern Ireland. But there is some limited cooperation on missile defense up to a point, and that's always a good thing. U.S., Japanese, and South Korean militaries have cooperated on missile defense up to a point. And recently they've had some trilateral exercises specifically directed for linking missile defense systems. Well, if not linking, at least coordinating. But the South Koreans have refused, as I understand it, to really expand and more formalize a trilateral relationship, even in the missile defense field, as I understand it, and certainly in the sort of in a broader military perspective, that the Koreans really just are, although they will meet with the Japanese, they really won't move forward with any sort of real trilateral arrangement. And the Korean president recently basically said as much just a few days ago, that there was only so much they would do, and that was that. The Americans have tried to bring the three sides together over the years, but really beyond but they haven't gotten very far. And at some point, you know, it may become necessary to tell the Koreans to grow up. And, you know, there is no choice. And we had never played rough. We more tried to persuade and use logic. But it probably would take a real threat to actually say, okay, fellas, you're on your own. If you're not going to actually act like adults. But I'm not too optimistic about how far or fast this will move. So there is a lot of, I would say the Korea dislike of the Japanese is probably as great as it's been. Really in the last 50 years. It used to be a lot worse, actually. The Japanese don't see it that way. They see themselves as trying to be friends, but the other side doesn't want to play. And so I think that's where we are. It hasn't emerged into a real concrete trilateral defense relationship at all, despite some limited cooperation and engagement around the edges. Where there is the most... I think where it is most advanced would be in the missile defense field.
Got it. You have an article in the Asia Times. You can find this at www.atimes.com. Headline is this: Asia's Troubles, Trump's Inheritance Not His Doing. Talk to us about that. It seems to me the more, you know, I have you on the program and the more, you know, the smarter you make me, Asia's a part of the world that we simply haven't invested in. We've tried to steer. I have this cartoon in my head of Uncle Sam tiptoeing around the Pacific, trying to get everybody to play nice, but they have no intention of playing nice. So talk to us about what he inherited, and your article that you published today.
What he inherited was, as I've mentioned, he's got a China which is really expanding militarily. It's immensely powerful economically, and it's really in the president, the head of it, Xi Jinping, has managed to bring all the power together under his own control. And they have their avowed objective of making Asia theirs and ejecting the United States. And as I've noted, they've taken the base. They've got de facto control, which is different than 100% control. But they pretty much control the South China Sea, physically and almost psychologically. And the East China Sea is next, and they are economically that they are become, if they aren't already, they are just about to become the main player in Asia, and I think they are already. So you've got this situation of Chinese dominance, but and also say psychological dominance almost. You have a North Korea that has advanced missiles, and its nuclear weapons have gotten pretty good, and they're apparently miniaturizing them. He had a situation where the ties had sort of shifted a bit or a lot towards the Chinese because the previous administration had tried to humiliate them after the Thai changed government via a coup, like they always do. The Filipinos had switched over towards the Chinese or shifted towards the Chinese when the United States refused to protect them and defend the Philippines when China took Scarborough Shoal in 2012. And then when the Americans encouraged the Filipinos to sue China over Chinese island building operations in the South China Sea, they did that at the Hague in the Netherlands. And the Philippines the decision was overwhelmingly in Philippines' favor. The Americans did nothing. They said almost nothing about that. And they did that as a favor to the Chinese so they wouldn't embarrass them. Well, the Philippines got the message, and the rest of Asia saw this as well. So here you have Mr. Trump get elected, and here's the irony of it all, and this is what led to the article, is that he's routinely being savaged by the American foreign policy community, and this includes the never-Trumpers, too. but particularly the Democratic side. And it's by the people who were in charge when everything I just described happened. You have a fellow named Kurt Campbell, for example, who's the one who got bamboozled at by the Chinese at Scarborough Shoal. He just absolutely got cheated, did nothing about it, and that really set all these wheels in motion in terms of China really saying, well, nobody's going to stop us. Here we go. We're going to build islands, and we are really going to throw our weight around. Taiwan, there's never knowing if it's going to be thrown under the bus or traded to China for something. They've had this uncertainty for years, and a fellow named Evan Medeiros was an Asia-Pacific policy player in the Obama administration. He deserves some credit for that. He's criticizing Mr. Trump all the time. Susan Rice did more to appease China than anybody. And so you have all these people who are, say, savaging Mr. Trump over what he's doing or not doing in Asia, and they're the ones who got us into this mess. The article lays it out in 850 words. But what you have and what you compare it to is, say, a baseball game. Say it's the bottom of the eighth and you're down by seven, and a relief pitcher comes in, and the four previous pitchers who gave up these seven runs, or all these runs, are criticizing the relief pitcher as soon as he gets in, and also telling him what he ought to be throwing. These are the guys who put the team in, put him down by seven runs, and now they're the ones criticizing and telling what to do. There's just something that's basically kind of dumb about this and certainly unfair. And I would say the same thing if no matter who the president was, that this is silly. But that's the what's led to the article. But it's not helpful, certainly from the U.S. perspective, because we say this sort of sniping and churlish treatment of the president, any president, is unhelpful. The Chinese are glad to see it going on. But so that's what led to the article.
Isn't that, though, just the way we play politics now? Isn't that the whole, I go back to, something that at the time made my blood boil. And I honestly, I think if I saw Harry Reid, I would punch him in the face. And I wouldn't even speak to him. But the whole, the war is lost. That wasn't a statement of fact or in any way, shape, or form. A statement of the situation on the ground. It was simply a statement made in an attempt to capture the White House. And so have we become such a pathetic nation that it's only about winning the White House, that that as soon as the other party owns the presidency, you simply burn it down? It doesn't matter the truth or anything. Isn't that the way we do it now, Grant?
I think it's all for a long time. It's that notion that, for foreign affairs and foreign policy, once you've got a sort of, went overseas, at that point there was an element of decorum that was expected of politicians. But that, I think that's broken down some time ago. That sort of criticism of a sitting president's policy is common. That's not unusual. But what really got me on this one, and something you don't see, is that the people who were directly responsible for the disadvantage, the bad position the Americans are in, these are the people yelling the loudest. When you have that, say, when it's so obvious that they were the ones who were to blame for the problems we're facing, when they're the ones who are, yelling like this, that's what I think is different. And it's just the breathtaking hypocrisy of it, sort of a combination of chutzpah and irony here, that it was worth 850 words. But it really is when, you read the papers, listen to the news, and you hear these people commenting. And if if you do follow Asia like I do, that, you realize, but hey, wait a minute, you're the guys who were in charge. You're the pilot who crashed the airplane, and, somehow you miraculously survive, even though many of the passengers died, and now you expect to be a flight safety instructor. They say that's the angle that I find unusual. Is the just the complete lack of introspection and any sort of remorse as to just to having failed at what they did. And this is the pedigreed elite, you know, who have put us in this position. And really, this is the first time the United States is on the verge of being pushed out of an entire region, with all of the knock-on effects that come of that, both militarily, psychologically, and economically.
Grant, no,
so, you can see I'm very resentful still at 1 a.m. in the morning.
Again, we don't focus on the Pacific Rim, you know, until something like this happens, and then it's unfathomable for us to think that we simply roll over and roll over and placate and roll over, all to what, maintain these incredibly great trade relationships we have with different entities in the Pacific. And I don't know, it just baffles one how people think that the country is going to go to a better place, that stability is going to be enhanced when you go down this road. I guess I don't. I it's a head scratcher to me when I hear these things.
Yeah, it's not. I think, well, with China, the idea was, and this was the basic premise, like a science experiment, that if you accommodate China, they will become like us. That they will liberalize. They will recognize that the system the U.S. has put in place or backstops in the United States is to their benefit, and they will, say, become like Americans. That was proven false in short order, but and nobody would challenge the hypothesis, although the one people who did or did or tried were ostracized and ridiculed and sort of definitely sidelined. You've had 45 years of data on which to, you know, assess how your experiment is going. But then the other part to watch out, to look for, is you should always look to where people are getting their money from. You know, are they making money out of China, either directly, either by business or on the payroll in some cases, or do they think they're going to make a ton of money out of China? Is that the flow of money or the hopes of getting it, which is part of the equation, that's helped put us into a bad position right now. But, you know, 45 years, you should have some idea that what you're trying to do isn't working out very well. And, you know, you must give the Chinese some credit for having, you know, taken what they can get. And they will do that until they can't get, until somebody stops them. Or someone just simply says no. We just haven't been willing to say no for a good long while.
Grant Newsham, our guest. With that as a backdrop of essentially this shit sandwich that the president gets handed relative to the Pacific, let's take the Korean thing, which seems to suck all the air out of the room here. Let's take that off the table. After the Korean thing, what are the major prioritize? Give me three priorities that the United States ought to be looking at other than North Korea.
I think that an excessive focus on North Korea is probably good. The first three priorities ought to be China, and coming up with a national strategy or a strategy and things to do that will sort of provide some sort of a pushback or some to Chinese efforts to expand and dominate, but also to promote our interests, to guarantee our interests, and to guarantee the interests of our friends in Asia who are counting on us. That really has to be the by far the top priorities. I'd say North Korea is almost it's definitely related to China because China could stop it any time it wants. But I would, in some ways, that's almost a discrete I wouldn't say separate because it's not unrelated. But North Korea's the bigger problem is China, to my way of thinking. And then it is this network of alliances that we have in the region, which ultimately are countries that have some value, so put some value on things we put value on, individual freedom, open trade, an international system where big countries don't bully little countries where there's laws that people follow, sort of what we might call the civilized world that was came into being maybe after World War II, that's the thing that America should be protecting, but it does require us to look after our friends out here. Because individually, they haven't got a chance against China, but collectively, but really only with us have they got a prayer. And also for us to maintain our position, we need these countries to be on our side. And that's really where the priority needs to be is what is doing something about Chinese aggression. And it's not just in the region, actually. They've played their hand very well, and they've been able to expand their influence worldwide. But Asia is the place to really where we're focusing on, and that's where it rightfully, that's where we need to be concentrating. North Korea, that would be, it's a secondary issue, but it make, given that it's nuclear weapons involved and really missiles that can hit an awful lot of stuff and getting more and more accurate, that does need to be taken really seriously. And I don't know that there's a whole lot of room left to sort of to ignore the problem and push it into the future. Given the level to which North Korean missiles and nuclear technology has advanced, this is going to have to be resolved one way or another before too long. I don't think it will last for another administration. So that's what I would see. There's China, the big thing, North Korea next. But to deal with China, you have to do a lot of other things, and that's particularly the alliance network. Need some specific attention. And I wouldn't ignore the South Pacific islands, where Chinese political warfare has been very effective in sort of insinuating China. Commercial interests and, to a degree, military interests, they always come along later. That needs some attention as well. So some advice would be to look at the entire map. And it'd be nice if the USC, the Foreign Service, and the political world, if everybody wants to go to Geneva or somewhere good, but they don't pay much attention to the Pacific Islands. It just takes a little effort, and they could do a lot. But the Chinese have insinuated themselves pretty nicely in Fiji, Tonga, Vanuatu, and a number of other places that really get very little attention. So looking at the whole map is very helpful. India, of course, deserves a mention because the efforts that have been made towards India by Mr. Bush and even the Obama administration did some things good towards build a relationship with India. That's important as well. It requires a lot of effort, though, to bring them in into a solid, sort of a reasonable alliance that would actually really help to contain China. It is containing China, but also it's just defending our interests, and that's really the flip side of that. And there should be no apologizing for defending American and really the free world's interests in the Asia Pacific region.
Here's an interesting email, Mac. It sounds like we're in similar situations in Eastern Europe and in the Western Pacific. Our alliances need to be repaired. Our partners need to bolster themselves defensively. Once those fences are mended in both cases, I do believe that we have credible deterrence in both regions. However, the state of disrepair of our allies, along with our lack of tending to those relationships, seems to me like we've been put in a poor situation, at least in the short term, maybe out to the midterm. I do believe, though, the president's action vis-a-vis NATO have led to very positive things. And I believe our allies in Eastern Europe have been encouraged by not only his frank discussions, but his attendance to meetings when he went there recently. And also, their spending levels have increased. Troop deployments to Eastern Europe and the Baltics have all been met with parades and joy as the United States finally does something vis-a-vis the Russian menace there. I don't think our actions in the Western Pacific ought to be too different. Our partners need to have robust militaries. Our alliances are good, but they can't be simply paper alliances. I'd be curious what Grant has to say about that. So, Newsham, what say ye about that?
Well, if I had been able to memorize it, I would just say whatever you just said. It was said very nicely. I think it says it well.
So you're going to give me what he said?
No, I am. Well, no, I'm not getting paid to do that. But the comments are right on target. One of the things that shaped the in Asia Pacific is that there's never been anything like a NATO. So there isn't really any sort of regional sense of cooperation except technically the New Zealanders and the Australians and the British had something with the Malaysians down in Southeast Asia, and it still exists, but there hasn't been anything like a NATO. So that's a big difference. And as a result, we have a system of relationships or military relationships which are just bilateral, and it's referred to as a hub-and-spoke relationship. So it's the United States and whoever, United States, Japan, United States, South Korea, United States, Australia. But you don't have anything linking the spokes, and that didn't really matter so much, I suppose, as long as China wasn't a problem. There really wasn't anything to challenge that system. And also, it didn't really matter that much to those countries if they were capable of doing anything more than attacking or fighting their neighbor if their neighbor tried to take, a square inch of their territory. There was never any sense of an outside threat that caused the nations to get together in Asia, if they would have even done that. That's different now. And as a result, there is this requirement to. Before I get on that, someone will say, "Well, what about ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations?"
Yeah,
that is not an Asian NATO. It's at best at most like an economic. Political sort of grouping in the sense that they get together to have meetings. And there's some sort of economic, as an economic aspect to the association. But it's not anything at all like a NATO. So it needs a new approach to this, which is trying to the Americans would do well to try and conceive of a structure where they have the nations that will cooperate sort of start doing more with each other. But also, they do need, as the writer said, they do need to improve their own militaries, which really, without exception, need improving. The Australians, not surprisingly, are farthest along, but that's because they're the Australians. But they really do need to improve their militaries, and we need to both require them to do it, but also help them do this. And one of the problems with the U.S. taking a more active role is that there's only so much out here. For example, there's only so many Marines, there's so many Army people, there's only so many Navy ships, so many aircraft. And you just need more of this. You can only be in so many places doing so many things, and without more people and more things, it gets hard to sort of expand your influence. In a certain sense, but there's one thing. Since this is all Marine radio, one thing the Marines have never done effectively is in this regard, and it's something concrete the Marines could do, is they've never put say the right sort of Marine in friendly countries with the mission of selling amphibious capability, with the mission of building up local amphibious capabilities, and as a sort of a secondary objective of linking regional amphibious forces together so they can operate together, train together, exercise together, with the U.S. getting involved sometimes, sometimes not. But that requires a permanent presence. And the Marines have apparently, with 16,000 active duty officers and twice as many in the reserves, they haven't got a single officer to spare for a scheme that would require about 7 or 8 Marine officers to get out and build up amphibious forces and sell amphibious capabilities. That is just one example of how you could actually go about improving regional capabilities. And when you can fight better and have a better military, it's psychologically important. You have a sense that, well, maybe I don't have to submit to Han Chinese domination. But additionally to what the writer said, there's also an economic angle. And that is that China's economy has been allowed to develop in such a way that it is able to come around offering a ton of money to a lot of countries in Asia, allegedly with no strings attached, but there always are. It's a terrible deal when you borrow or get money from the Chinese. But also they do serve as a huge export market for a lot of countries in the region. So there's an economic aspect, an angle that needs to be addressed. And we need to make the American market a more attractive market as well. So there's a military and an economic component to this that needs addressed. And also, of course, the political angle, which does require the Americans to actually speak up on behalf of American interests, speak up on behalf of friendly nations' interests in this region. But all you ever hear is the Chinese side of things, and they are very good at what you'd call strategic communications or strategic bullying. And if it goes unchallenged, it doesn't matter if it's wrong. But it has historically gone unchallenged. We just are not able, for whatever reason, to address really Chinese verbal attacks on us and our beliefs. Now, maybe one day we'll wake up. But I thought the what was described was very well stated.
The ability, as you just mentioned, of the Chinese to use economic warfare against their allies—that is no small. That is no small event, right? Okay, if you want to go down that road, we'll simply cut off, you know, our trade relationship with you. And so, how do nations, Australia being one of them, the Philippines being another, how do nations navigate that kind of? That economic warfare piece of this?
Well, with difficulty in most cases. For example, you cut off banana exports from the Philippines. Well, we just want to say, well, you go to the supermarket and there's a lot of other stuff besides bananas. But in the Philippines case, bananas is a huge export market. It's a huge export product. And so, yeah, that poses just a huge problem for a country that it's not a big country and only has certain products, certain things they sell, that China is pretty good at, or is pretty brazen and used throwing its weight around. It's all quite illegal under the sort of World Trade Organization regulations, but they do it anyway. But what the Americans can do, and this is where the Americans really do need to view this as economic warfare that's going on, is what America can do is... Okay, if China's going to do that, we have plenty of ways to make them pay for that economically. And so we can apply pressure quite effectively on them. I don't think bringing suit to the World Trade Organization is that big a deal, other than, say, something you might do if you have extra time to eventually embarrass the Chinese. But really, it has to be an immediate effort, something that causes them financial harm, and that really is possible for us to do. But also, if the Philippines can't sell their bananas in China, well, then we'll find a place for it to buy them. You know, we'll take them. There's ways around this. You've got to help out your friends, and it's money well spent if you do that. So when China applies pressure somewhere, we should apply pressure on them elsewhere, but also look after our friends. You know, and that's one of the things that the Trump administration should have done better when the Chinese put pressure on South Korea economically over the South Koreans installing the anti-missile, the THAAD anti-missile system recently, is that you still had the Trump administration calling for trying to pick a fight over trade or talking about unfair, South Korea's unfair trade advantage over the United States, what we should have been doing is saying, okay, that's what China's doing. Well, this is what we're going to do to take care of you. And that is basically the right approach, is for U.S. to apply its substantial pressure on China when it tries to do this, and at the same time help out our friends economically. The Australians are the ones who in recent years have tried to convince themselves that China was such an important market, such an important economic partner, that the Americans weren't all that important, even militarily. It's an internal debate that's been going on, and it's I'm not sure who's going to win. But the Australians, I think, when they stopped and looked at it, they've actually got some pretty good economic alternatives to the Chinese market. They're not as dependent as they thought. But each country's situation will be a little different. But as I said, consider we are in a state of economic war when one of our friends is attacked. We can apply economic pressure to defend them, and that's something well within our capabilities.
Here's another email, Grant. Mac, it seems to me that we are simply asleep at the switch, that we simply wish these things away. I think history has taught every one of us that peace through strength is the best way to ensure that you never fight. What am I missing here? What does the United States hope to achieve by this passive posture in the Pacific? Passive posture in the Pacific. That's a lot of P's right there. It kind of sings. Might be a headline for you, Grant. Think about it. But I think, well said. What?
I think the writer has described the human experience, probably going back to caveman days. But if you one way to look at this is that about every 7 years Wall Street comes up with some new scam that is a surefire can't miss make a ton of money proposition. It was the .com in the early 2000s, then the real estate boom, and then whatever, and then go back even farther. And you'll always find something. It seems about every 7 years, which is how long it takes people to forget the previous one. But everyone will be addressed with the offer. Well, this is different. This is not a pyramid scheme. This is different, and that's exactly what the person just described in Asia is that this is different. That military preparedness isn't important anymore. It's somehow that these enduring truths of the human experience just don't apply because we're modern people. We have international relations degrees from Harvard. Whatever it is, we take showers every day instead of once a week. We dress better. We have internet. We must be smarter than everyone who's come before us. And therefore, that military strength isn't important. We can talk things out. History is ended. Major wars couldn't possibly happen. The Cold War's gone. America won, and that's that. But it's any number of excuses to get people who should know better to do stupid things and not take necessary precautions that put us into a very difficult position. But if you just use the expression, well, this is different. And whenever you hear Wall Street say that, you know that it's not different. And so if you let down your guard that bad people or bad countries are going to take advantage of it, and if your guard is up, they won't, and they won't be able to, and that's in some ways a lesson most people learned on the playground at about the age of five. So the statement was correct.
All right, last question, and I hope you don't mind if we have you back on here a few times in the next couple weeks. As the president goes bombing through Asia, and get your thoughts on the things that come out of it. What's the next big thing we're going to see in this relative to North Korea, relative to this American, Japanese, South Korea triangle, and then China kind of in its own circle off to the side?
I think we're going to see what you call another North Korean provocation. You know, that will come as just as certainly as the Redskins winning the Super Bowl. Unfortunately, it's more likely to come than that.
I was going to say, it's way more likely.
Yeah, I think that's coming. You know, it will. It's just a question of when. You know, there'll be a missile shot, a nuclear test, you know, some variation on that. But that will come. And then, that's what's coming next. But I think that just a guess, it wouldn't surprise me if the U.S. side sees that China's the key and you've got to do something different with China. And I wouldn't be surprised if this administration, you know, does try to do something different with China. And I have a feeling that there may be some sort of a systematic scheme that is introduced to try to put some more pressure on the People's Republic of China. How it will succeed and how it will go, I don't know. But I think that's probably coming. But certainly provocation from North Korea. And since the alternative to actually going to war with North Korea is getting the Chinese to close off the taps to North Korea as to apply pressure, I think that the effort from the administration will be directed towards China to get them to do something. I don't know how that will turn out, but it's certainly something that should be tried. So that was how I would see the big thing that's coming.
All right, sir. First of all, I want to thank you for staying up late in Tokyo and wish you safe travels. How long will you be in Tokyo?
Well, I'll be here for about 10 days or so, for a little while. So, okay. Mm-hmm.
All right.
I always enjoy talking. I was I just woke up before you called, so I feel like I'm talking in my sleep. I have no idea what I said,
if you did, it was quality conversation in your sleep. The rest of us should be so lucky. What about did you enjoy the World Series?
I was pretty sure the Nationals had it in the bag too.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, but not that it was good. But I suppose if I wanted anyone, it was the Dodgers. But I wasn't either way. I don't. You know, I slept pretty well at the end of it. But it was a good. I thought good series. I thought it was nice. It was nice to see those people from Houston finally have something good happen.
Yeah,
since it is Houston after all.
It is Houston, hot and humid. Yeah. So. And then with their flow. All right, sir. I appreciate your time this morning. You know, Grant, it is just so head scratching. I don't know, you know, like the pacification of, you know, of the United States, where we don't think that these instruments are going to have to be used. And the sure way historically to see it that they get used is go ahead and be weak. You know, go ahead and be weak, and they will most certainly be used. And so, I don't know, it's just depressing. It is disillusioning to think that we have leaders that come to power and think that the world has fundamentally changed, you know, and that we are somehow or other going to be different. And so we can either disarm, or we don't have to tend to these relationships, or we can believe that I've looked at in Vladimir Putin's eyes, and he's a man I can do business with. He's a man I can trust. You know, and it's just, I don't know. It's just very, very disappointing and disillusioning.
It can be. You know, we're not the first ones to experience it. And it's been going on forever. You know, we do have a pedigreed class that kind of controls foreign affairs in the United States. And there's even it's even in the military. We have there's a part of that pedigree class in the military, and they've simply failed, you know, in the last 45 years. You know, it's not like they, you know, kind of succeeded. No, they failed, and that's disappointing, as there have been voices in the wilderness who've been speaking up. You remember Admiral Willard at PACOM was one of those. Captain Jim Fennell, the head of intelligence at PAC Fleet, was basically fired a couple of years ago for suggesting that China had warlike intentions, and So there's always been good people who know what ends up, and you know, unfortunately, we have enough around, and hopefully we'll make use of them and actually cultivate them, and have some of these people who are now criticizing Mr. Trump so stridently just go and leave us alone for a while. So we at least have a chance, I think, and we'll see how it goes.
All right. Grant, first of all, thank you very much for staying up so late for us. Always appreciate the conversation, and travel safe.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I'll talk to you later.
You can find his work in Asia Times online, Grant Newsham. Makes it smart all the time relative to the Pacific. You know, again, it just, I don't know, it's head-shaking. As you look at the macro level, you know, what do we have here? What are we prepared to do? How does it work? You know, is that thing strong? No, well, they're cutting their spending here. Okay, well, let me go talk to them. That can't happen. We have to agree on these things, and we have to hit these targets. And again, why other presidents, Bush, Obama, Clinton, you know, why they didn't throw a bigger fit relative to NATO spending? Good question. Why not? You gotta. I would offer this. The way to get your head kicked in is to not tend to your blind side. That's the way to get your head kicked in. And so, in Iraq, if you didn't provide for your security in 360 degrees, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at some point you would pay for it. And that is the lesson when you deal with people like that. All right, we're going to take a break. Mike Musselman's going to join us next as we continue here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.